Chapter 4 What Caspian Did There. Next morning, the Lord Byrne called his guests early, and after breakfast he asked Caspian to order every man he had into full armour. "And above all," he added, "let everything be as trim and scoured as if it were the morning of the first battle in a great war between noble kings, with all the world looking on." This was done. And then, in three boatloads, Caspian and his people, and Byrne with a few of his, put out for Narrowhaven. The king's flag flew in the stern of his boat, and his trumpeter was with him. When they reached the jetty at Narrowhaven, Caspian found a considerable crowd assembled to meet them. "This is what I sent word about last night," said Byrne. "They are all friends of mine, and honest people." And as soon as Caspian stepped ashore, the crowd broke out into hoorays and shouts of "Narnia! Narnia! Long live the king!" At the same moment, and this was also due to Byrne's messengers, bells began ringing from many parts of the town. Then Caspian caused his banner to be advanced and his trumpet to be blown, and every man drew his sword and set his face into a joyful sternness, and they marched up the street, so that the street shook, and their armour shone, for it was a sunny morning, so that one could hardly look at it steadily. At first, the only people who cheered were those who had been warned by Byrne's messenger, and knew what was happening, and wanted it to happen. But then all the children joined in, because they liked a procession, and had seen very few. And then all the schoolboys joined in, because they also liked processions, and felt that the more noise and disturbance there was, the less likely they would be to have any school that morning. And then all the old women put their heads out of doors and windows and began chattering and cheering because it was a king. And what is a governor compared with that? And all the young women joined in for the same reason, and also because Caspian and Drinian and the rest were so handsome. And then all the young men came to see what the young women were looking at, so that by the time Caspian reached the castle gates, nearly the whole town was shouting. And where Gumper sat in the castle, muddling and messing about with accounts and forms and rules and regulations, he heard the noise. At the castle gate, Caspian's trumpeter blew a blast and cried, "Open for the King of Narnia! Come to visit his trusty and well-beloved servant, the Governor of the Lone Islands." In those days, everything in the islands was done in a slovenly, slouching manner. Only the little postern opened, and out came a tousled fellow with a dirty old hat on his head instead of a helmet, and a rusty old pike in his hand. He blinked at the flashing figures before him.
"Can't seize fishancy," he mumbled,
which was his way of saying, "You can't see his sufficiency."
"No interviews without appointment except between 9:10 p.m. second Saturday every month."
"Uncover before Narnia, you dog," thundered the Lord Byrne, and dealt him a rap with his gauntleted hand, which sent his hat flying from his head.
"Yeah, what's he all about?" began the doorkeeper,
but no one took any notice of him. Two of Caspian's men stepped through the postern, and after some struggling with bars and bolts, for everything was rusty, flung both wings of the gate wide open. Then the king and his followers strode into the courtyard. Here a number of the governor's guards were lounging about, and several more, they were mostly wiping their mouths, came tumbling out of various doorways. Though their armour was in a disgraceful condition, these were fellows who might have fought if they had been led, or had known what was happening. So this was the dangerous moment. Caspian gave them no time to think. "Where is the captain?" he asked.
"I am, more or less, if you know what I mean," said a languid and rather dandified young person, without any armour at all.
"It is our wish," said Caspian, "that our royal visitation to our realm of the Lone Islands should, if possible, be an occasion of joy
and not of terror to our loyal subjects. If it were not for that, I should have something to say about the state of your men's armour and weapons. As it is, you are pardoned. Command a cask of wine to be opened, that your men may drink our health. But at noon tomorrow, I wish to see them here in this courtyard, looking like men-at-arms and not like vagabonds. See to it, on pain of our extreme displeasure."
The captain gaped, but Byrne immediately cried,
"Three cheers for the king!"
And the soldiers, who had understood about the cask of wine, even if they understood nothing else, joined in. Caspian then ordered most of his own men to remain in the courtyard. He, with Byrne and Drinian and four others, went into the hall.
Behind a table at the far end, with various secretaries about him, sat His Sufficiency, the governor of the Lone Islands. Gumpus was a bilious-looking man, with hair that had once been red, and now was mostly grey. He glanced up as the strangers entered, and then looked down at his papers, saying automatically,
"No interviews without appointments, except between 9 and 10 p.m. on the set and Saturdays."
Caspian nodded to Byrne and then stood aside. Byrne and Drinian took a step forward, and each seized one end of the table. They lifted it and flung it on one side of the hall, where it rolled over, scattering a cascade of letters, dossiers, inkpots, pens, sealing wax, and documents. Then, not roughly, but as firmly as if their hands were pincers of steel, they plucked Gumpus out of his chair and deposited him, facing it, about 4 feet away. Caspian at once sat down in the chair and laid his naked sword across his knees. "My lord," said he, fixing his eyes on Gumpus, "you have not given us quite the welcome we expected. I am the King of Narnia."
"Nothing about it in the correspondence," said the governor.
"Nothing in the minutes. We have not been notified of any such thing. All irregular. Happy to consider any applications."
"And we are come to inquire into Your Sufficiency's conduct of your office," continued Caspian. "There are 2 points, especially, on which I require an explanation. Firstly, I find no record that the tribute due from these islands to the Crown of Narnia has been received for about 150 years.
"That will be a question to raise at the council next month," said Gumpus. "If anyone moves that a commission of inquiry be set up to report on the financial history of the islands at the first meeting next year, why then—"
"I also find it very clearly written in our laws," Caspian went on, "that if the tribute is not delivered, the whole debt has to be paid by the governor of the Lone Islands out of his private purse."
At this, Gumpus began to pay real attention.
"Oh, that's quite out of the question," he said. "It's an economic impossibility. Your Majesty must be joking."
Inside, he was wondering if there were any way of getting rid of these unwelcome visitors. Had he known that Caspian had only one ship and one ship's company with him, he would have spoken soft words for the moment and hoped to have them all surrounded and killed during the night. But he had seen a ship of war sail down the straits yesterday and seen it signalling, as he supposed, to its consorts. He had not then known it was the king's ship, for there was not wind enough to spread the flag out and make the golden lion visible, so he had waited further developments. Now he imagined that Caspian had a whole fleet at Burnstead. It would never have occurred to Gumpus that anyone would walk into Narrow Haven to take the islands with fewer than 50 men. It was certainly not at all the kind of thing he could imagine doing himself.
"Secondly," said Caspian, "I want to know why you have permitted this abominable and unnatural traffic in slaves to grow up here, contrary to the ancient custom and usage of our dominions."
"Necessary, unavoidable," said His Sufficiency. "An essential part of the economic development of the islands, I assure you. Our present burst of prosperity depends on it."
"What need have you of slaves?"
"For export, Your Majesty. Sell 'em to Calamen mostly. And we have other markets. We are a great centre of the trade."
"In other words," said Caspian, "you don't need them. Tell me what purpose they serve, except to put money into the pockets of such as Pug."
"Your Majesty's tender years," said Gumpus,
with what was meant to be a fatherly smile, hardly make it possible that you should understand the economic problem involved. I have statistics, I have graphs, I have... "Tender as my ears may be," said Caspian, "I believe I understand the slave trade from within quite as well as your sufficiency, and I do not see that it brings into the islands meat, or bread, or beer, or wine, or timber, or cabbages, or books, or instruments of music, or horses, or armour, or anything else worth having. But whether it does or not, it must be stopped."
"But that would be putting the clock back," gasped the governor. "Have you no idea of progress, of development?"
"I have seen them both in an egg," said Caspian. "We call it going bad in Narnia. This trade must stop."
"I can take no responsibility for any such measure," said Gampus.
"Very well, then," answered Caspian. "We relieve you of your office. My Lord Byrne, come here." And before Gampus quite realized what was happening, Byrne was kneeling with his hands between the king's hands and taking the oath to govern the Lone Islands in accordance with the old customs, rites, usages, and laws of Narnia. And Caspian said, "I think we've had enough of governors," and made Byrne a duke, the Duke of the Lone Islands. "As for you, my lord," he said to Gampus, "I forgive you your debt for the tribute, but before noon tomorrow, you and yours must be out of the castle, which is now the Duke's residence."
"Look here, this is all very well," said one of Gumbus's secretaries, "but suppose all you gentlemen stop play-acting and we do a little business. The question before us really is..."
"The question is," said the Duke, "whether you and the rest of the rabble will leave without a flogging or with one. You may choose which you prefer." When all this had been pleasantly settled, Caspian ordered horses, of which there were a few in the castle, though very ill-groomed, and he, with Byrne and Drinian and a few others, rode out into the town and made for the slave market. It was a long, low building near the harbour, and the scene which they found going on inside was very much like any other auction. That is to say, there was a great crowd, and Pug, on a platform, was roaring out in a raucous voice,
"Now, gentlemen, lot 23, fine Trebinthian agricultural labourer, suitable for the mines or the galleys. Under 25 years of age, not a bad tooth in his head, good brawny fellow. Take off his shirt, Tax, and let the gentleman see. There's muscle for you. Look at that chest on him. 10 crescents from the gentleman in the corner? You must be joking, sir. 15, 18. 18 is bid for lot 23. Any of ours an 18? 21, thank you, sir. 21 is bid."
But Pug stopped and gaped when he saw the mail-clad figures who had clanked up to the platform.
"On your knees, every man of you, to the King of Narnia," said the Duke.
Everyone heard the horses jingling and stamping outside, and many had heard some rumour of the landing and the events at the castle. Most obeyed. Those who did not were pulled down by their neighbours. Some cheered.
"Your life is forfeit, Pug, for laying hands on our royal person yesterday," said Caspian. "But your ignorance is pardoned. The slave trade was forbidden in our dominions 1/4 hour ago. I declare every slave in this market free." He held up his hand to check the cheering of the slaves and went on, "Where are my friends?"
"That dear little girl and the nice young gentleman," said Pug with an ingratiating smile. "Why, they were snapped up at once."
"We're here! We're here, Caspian!" cried Lucy and Edmund together. And...
"At your service, sire,"
piped Reby Cheep from another corner. They had all been sold, but the men who had bought them were staying to bid for other slaves, and so they had not yet been taken away. The crowd parted to let the three of them out, and there was great hand-clasping and greeting between them and Caspian. Two merchants of Calamen at once approached. The Calamen have dark faces and long beards. They wear flowing robes and orange-coloured turbans, and they are a wise, wealthy, courteous, cruel, and ancient people. They bowed most politely to Caspian and paid him long compliments, all about the fountains of prosperity, irrigating the gardens of prudence and virtue, and things like that. But, of course, what they wanted was the money they had paid. "That is only fair, sirs," said Caspian. "Every man who was bought a slave today must have his money back. Pug, bring out your takings to the last minim." A minim is the 40th part of a crescent.
"Does your good majesty mean to beggar me?"
whined Pug. "You have lived on broken hearts all your life," said Caspian, "and if you are beggared, it is better to be a beggar than a slave. But where is my other friend?"
"Oh, him," said Pug. "I'll take him and welcome. Glad to have him off me hands. I've never seen such a drug in the market in all my born days. Priced him at 5 crescents in the end, and even so nobody'd have him. Threw him in free with the other lots, and still no one would have him. Wouldn't touch him, wouldn't look at him. Tax, bring out Sulky."
Thus Eustace was produced, and sulky he certainly looked. For though no one would want to be sold as a slave, it is perhaps even more galling to be a sort of utility slave whom no one will buy. He walked up to Caspian and said, "I see, as usual. Been enjoying yourself somewhere while the rest of us were prisoners? I suppose you haven't even found out about the British consul." "Of course not." That night they had a great feast in the castle of Narrow Haven, and then,
"Tomorrow, for the beginning of our real adventures," said Reepicheep,
when he had made his bows to everyone and went to bed. But it could not really be tomorrow, or anything like it, for now they were preparing to leave all known lands and seas behind them, and the fullest preparations had to be made. The Dawn Treader was emptied and drawn on land by 8 horses over rollers, and every bit of her was gone over by the most skilled shipwrights. Then she was launched again, and victualled and watered as full as she could hold, that is to say, for 28 days. Even this, as Edmund noticed with disappointment, only gave them a fortnight's eastward sailing before they had to abandon their quest. While all this was being done, Caspian missed no chance of questioning all the oldest sea captains whom he could find in Narrowhaven, to learn if they had any knowledge or even any rumours of land further to the east. He poured out many a flagon of the castle ale to weather-beaten men with short grey beards and clear blue eyes, and many a tall yarn he heard in return. But those who seemed the most truthful could tell of no lands beyond the Lone Islands, and many thought that if you sailed too far east, you would come into the surges of a sea without lands, that swirled perpetually round the rim of the world.
"And that, I reckon, is where your Majesty's friends went to the bottom."
The rest had only wild stories of islands inhabited by headless men, floating islands, water spouts, and a fire that burned along the water. Only one, to Reepicheep's delight, said,
"And beyond that, Aslan country. But that's beyond the end of the world, and you can't get there."
But when they questioned him, he could only say that he'd heard it from his father. Byrne could only tell them that he had seen his 6 companions sail away eastward, and that nothing had ever been heard of them again. He said this when he and Caspian were standing on the highest point of Abra, looking down on the eastern ocean.
"I've often been up here of a morning," said the Duke, "and seen the sun come up out of the sea, and sometimes it looked as if it were only a couple of miles away. And I've wondered about my friends, and wondered what there really is behind that horizon. Nothing, most likely. Yet I'm always half ashamed that I stayed behind. But I wish Your Majesty wouldn't go. We may need your help here. This closing the slave market might make a new world. War with Calumet is what I foresee. My liege, think again."
"I have an oath, my Lord Duke," said Caspian, And anyway, what could I say to Reepicheep?